spending time to generate novel ideas, procrastination has another benefit. It keeps us open to improvisation. When we plan well in advance, we often stick to the structure we've created, closing the door to creative possibilities that might spring into our fields of vision. Years ago, Berkeley psychologist Donald McKinnon discovered that the most creative architects in America tended to be more spontaneous than their technically skilled but unoriginal peers, who rated themselves higher in self-control and conscientiousness. In a study of pizza chains that I conducted with Francesca Gino and David Hoffman, the most profitable stores were run by leaders who rated themselves as the least efficient and prompt. Similarly, when strategy researchers Sucheta Nadkarni and Paul Herman studied nearly 200 companies in India, the firms with the highest financial returns were the ones whose CEOs rated themselves the lowest on efficiency and promptness. In both cases, the most successful organizations were run by executives who admitted that they often wasted time before settling down to work, and sometimes failed to pace themselves to get things done on time. Although these habits could impede progress on tasks, they opened leaders up to being more strategically flexible. In the Indian companies, multiple members of each company's top management teams rated their CEOs on strategic flexibility. The CEOs who planned carefully, acted early, and worked diligently scored as more rigid. Once they formulated a strategy, they stuck to it. The CEOs who tended to delay work were more flexible and versatile. They were able to change their strategies to capitalize on new opportunities and defend against threats. When new leaders take over a team or organization, they're often eager to institute changes. But there's value in being patient. In one experiment, Carnegie Mellon professor Anita Woolley gave teams 50 minutes to build a residential structure out of Legos, scored on dimensions like size, sturdiness, and aesthetics. She randomly assigned teams to discuss their strategies either at the beginning of the task or after 25 minutes. Teams that evaluated their strategies at the midpoint were 80% more effective than teams that had the conversation at the start. The beginning of the task was too early for the conversation to be useful. The task was unfamiliar, so they didn't know enough to set an effective strategy. There was something special about pausing at the midpoint that enabled the teams to construct tall, pleasing Lego buildings that had lots of rooms but could be lifted, flipped, and dropped without breaking. Yale researcher Connie Gersick finds that the midpoint of a task is often the best time for a leader to institute change, as it's when groups become most open to originality. They still have plenty of time to try new things, which makes them receptive to radically different approaches. And since they've used up half of their time, they're highly motivated to choose a good strategy. This is one of the reasons that halftimes can be so influential in basketball and football. They allow coaches to intervene when teams are most amenable to new strategies. As King walked to the podium to deliver his speech, even as he approached the microphone, he was still revising it. Just before King spoke, politician Drew Hansen writes in The Dream, he was crossing out lines and scribbling new ones as he awaited his turn. And it looked like King was still editing the speech until he walked to the podium to deliver it. In the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Bearing the Cross, historian David Garrow observes that King improvised like some sort of jazz musician. King acted spontaneously, beginning with small ad-libs. One of the early portions of the written speech, called The Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, a promise that all men would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At the podium, King expanded the line to emphasize racial equality. A promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights. It was 11 minutes into the speech that Mahalia Jackson called for King to share his dream. It is unclear whether he heard her, but Just all of a sudden, I decided, King recalled. He followed the emotion of the moment and unfolded his dream. By the time the speech was done, Hansen notes, King added so much new material to his prepared speech that the length of his address nearly doubled. Great originals are great procrastinators, but they don't skip planning altogether. They procrastinate strategically, making gradual progress by testing and refining different possibilities. Although the memorable lines about the dream were improvised, King had rehearsed variations of them in earlier speeches. He had spoken of his dream nearly a year earlier, in November 1962 in Albany, and in the ensuing months he referred to it frequently, from Birmingham to Detroit. During the year of his dream speech alone, it is estimated that he traveled over 275,000 miles and delivered over 350 speeches. While King may have deferred writing the dream speech, he had a wealth of material at his disposal that he could draw upon extemporaneously, which made his delivery more authentic. King had collected a repertoire of oratorical fragments, successful passages from his own sermons, sections from other preachers' work, anecdotes, Bible verses, lines from favorite poets, Hansen explains. King did not so much write his speeches as assemble them, by rearranging and adapting material he had used many times before. It gave King the flexibility to alter his addresses as he was speaking. Had King not decided to leave his written text, it is doubtful that his speech at the march would be remembered at all. Pioneers and Settlers. After being involved in starting over 100 companies, Idealab founder Bill Gross ran an analysis to figure out what drove success versus failure. The most important factor was not the uniqueness of the idea, the capabilities and execution of the team, the quality of the business model, or the availability of funding. The number one thing was timing, Gross reveals. Timing accounted for 42% of the difference between success and failure. Research shows that in American culture, people believe strongly in a first-mover advantage. We want to be leaders, not followers. Scientists rush to make discoveries ahead of their rivals. Inventors hurry to apply for patents before their adversaries. Entrepreneurs aspire to launch before their competitors. If you're the first out of the gate with a new product, service, or technology, you can move up the learning curve earlier, gobble up prime space, and monopolize customers. These edges create barriers to entry for your competitors. Their own efforts to innovate will be stifled by your patents and superior capabilities, and their growth will be stymied by the fact that it's expensive to convince customers to make a switch. In a classic study, marketing researchers Peter Golder and Gerard Tellis compared the success of companies that were either pioneers or settlers. The pioneers were first movers, the initial company to develop or sell a product. The settlers were slower to launch, waiting until the pioneers had created a market before entering it. When Golder and Tellis analyzed hundreds of brands in 36 different product categories, they found a staggering difference in failure rates. 47% for pioneers, compared with just 8% for settlers. Pioneers were about 6 times more likely to fail than settlers. Even when the pioneers did survive, they only captured an average of 10% of the market, compared with 28% for settlers. Surprisingly, the downsides of being the first mover are frequently bigger than the upsides. On balance, studies suggest that pioneers may sometimes capture greater market share, but end up not only with lower chances of survival, but lower profits as well. As marketing researcher Lisa Bolton summarizes, although first movers face some advantages in particular industries, the academic research remains mixed and does not support an overall first mover advantage. If you're someone who's tempted to rush into a new domain, this knowledge should stop you cold and leave you thinking carefully about the ideal timing. But Bolton finds something frightening. Even when people learn that evidence doesn't support the first-mover advantage, they still believe in it. It's easier to think of pioneers that succeeded. The failed ones are long forgotten, so we assume they're rare. The best way to shatter the myth of the first-mover advantage is to ask people to generate reasons for first-mover disadvantage. In your experience, what are the four biggest drawbacks of being a pioneer? Settlers are often branded as copycats, but this stereotype misses the mark. Instead of conforming to the existing demand, they bide their time until they're ready to introduce something new. They're often slow to enter because they're working on revolutionary products, services, or technologies within the category. In home video game consoles, the pioneer was Magnavox Odyssey in 1972, which mostly featured rudimentary sports games. A settler, Nintendo, acquired the Odyssey's distribution rights for Japan in 1975 and then blew Magnavox out of the water in the following decade by creating an original Nintendo Entertainment System that featured games like Super Mario Bros. And The Legend of Zelda. Nintendo transformed gaming with a user-friendly controller, sophisticated characters, and interactive role-playing. Being original doesn't require being first. It just means being different and better. When originals rush to be pioneers, they're prone to overstep. That's the first disadvantage. Before the internet bubble burst, a young Goldman Sachs banker named Joseph Park was sitting in his apartment, frustrated at the effort required to get access to entertainment. Why should he trek all the way to Blockbuster to rent a movie? He should just be able to open a website, pick out a movie, and have it delivered to his door. Despite raising around $250 million, Cosmo, the company Park founded, went bankrupt in 2001. His biggest mistake was making a brash promise for one-hour delivery of virtually anything, and investing in building national operations to support growth that never happened. One study of over 3,000 startups indicates that roughly 3 out of every 4 fail because of premature scaling, making investments that the market isn't yet ready to support. Had Park proceeded more slowly, he might have noticed that with the current technology available, one-hour delivery was an impractical and low-margin business. There was, however, a tremendous demand for online movie rentals. Netflix was just then getting off the ground, and Cosmo might have been able to compete in the area of mail-order rentals and then online movie streaming. Later, he might have been able to capitalize on technological changes that made it possible for Instacart to build a logistics operation that made one-hour grocery delivery scalable and profitable. Since the market is more defined when settlers enter, they can focus on providing superior quality instead of deliberating about what to offer in the first place. Wouldn't you rather be second or third and see how the guy in first did and then improve it? Malcolm Gladwell asked in an interview. When ideas get really complicated and when the world gets complicated, it's foolish to think the person who's first can work it all out, Gladwell remarked. Most good things, it takes a long time to figure them out. Moving too fast was one of the forces behind the flop of the Segway. Randy Komisar counseled patience, journalist Steve Kemper writes in Reinventing the Wheel, advising Dean Kamen's team to go slow and build a track record. Before the launch, Steve Jobs urged the team to do a complete redesign. Then they should run safety and usability studies on some university campuses and at Disney so that people could see it in action and begin craving it before it was available. Instead of heeding this advice, Kamen's team rushed the Segway to market without working out the customer, safety, legal, pricing, and design issues. Harvard entrepreneurship professor Bill Salmon was involved from the beginning, and to this day he wonders what might have happened if the Segway team had worked more slowly to prove the product's safety, improve the design, reduce costs, and obtain approvals to ride it on sidewalks in major cities. If it didn't look dorky, if it weighed 25 pounds and cost $700, it would sell, he says wistfully. Second, there's reason to believe that the kinds of people who choose to be late movers may be better suited to succeed. Risk seekers are drawn to being first, and they're prone to making impulsive decisions. Meanwhile, more risk-averse entrepreneurs watch from the sidelines, waiting for the right opportunity and balancing their risk portfolios before entering. In a study of software startups, strategy researchers Elizabeth Ponticus and William Barnett find that when entrepreneurs rush to follow the crowd into hyped markets, their startups are less likely to survive and grow. When entrepreneurs wait for the market to cool down, they have higher odds of success. Nonconformists that buck the trend are most likely to stay in the market, receive funding, and ultimately go public. Third, along with being less recklessly ambitious, settlers can improve upon competitors' technology to make products better. When you're the first to market, you have to make all the mistakes yourself. Meanwhile, settlers can watch and learn from your errors. Moving first is a tactic, not a goal, Peter Thiel writes in Zero to One. Being the first mover doesn't do you any good if someone else comes along and unseats you. Fourth, whereas pioneers tend to get stuck in their early offerings, settlers can observe market changes and shifting consumer tastes and adjust accordingly. In a study of the U.S. automobile industry over nearly a century, pioneers had lower survival rates because they struggled to establish legitimacy, developed routines that didn't fit the market, and became obsolete as consumer needs clarified. Settlers also have the luxury of waiting for the market to be ready. When Warby Parker launched, e-commerce companies had been thriving for more than a decade, though other companies had tried selling glasses online with little success. There's no way it would have worked before, Neil Blumenthal tells me. We had to wait for Amazon, Zappos, and Blue Nile to get people comfortable buying products they typically wouldn't order online. This holds true beyond the world of business, where many original people, ideas, and movements have failed because they were ahead of their time. At the CIA in the early 1990s, when Carmen Medina initially voiced her idea to share digital information online more rapidly, the agency wasn't ready to consider the concept. As electronic communication became more secure and more familiar, people became more receptive to the idea. After the terrorist attacks of September 11 and the misidentification of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, it became increasingly clear that the costs of failing to share information among agencies effectively were too consequential to bear. Timing is everything, Medina's colleague Susan Benjamin notes. In that intervening period, it became obvious to even people who were real Luddites that we had to do things differently. The times called for it. It became difficult for anyone who had half a brain in their head not to listen to her and agree that that was the direction in which to move. In the 1840s, when Hungarian physician Ignaz Semmelweis discovered that having medical students wash their hands dramatically reduced death rates during childbirth, he was scorned by his colleagues and ended up in an asylum. It would be two decades before his ideas gained scientific legitimacy, as Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch laid the foundations of germ theory. As physicist Max Planck once observed, a new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die. I don't mean to imply that it's never wise to be first. If we all wait for others to act, nothing original will ever be created. Someone has to be the pioneer, and sometimes that will pay off. First mover advantages tend to prevail when patented technology is involved, or when there are strong network effects. The product or service becomes more valuable when there are a greater number of users, as with telephones or social media. But in the majority of circumstances, your odds of success aren't higher if you go first. And when the market is uncertain, unknown, or underdeveloped, being a pioneer has pronounced disadvantages. The key lesson here is that if you have an original idea, it's a mistake to rush with the sole purpose of beating your competitors to the finish line. Just as procrastinating can give us flexibility on a task, delaying market entry can open us up to learning and adaptability, reducing the risks associated with originality. But what happens when we broaden the lens beyond task timetables and product life cycles? Over the course of a person's lifetime, is there a risk of waiting too long to act? The two life cycles of creativity, young geniuses and old masters. It's commonly believed that originality flows from the fountain of youth. In the words of famed venture capitalist Vinod Khosla, people under 35 are the people who make change happen. People over 45 basically die in terms of new ideas. After publishing his first revolutionary paper on relativity in his mid-20s, Albert Einstein made a similar observation. A person who has not made his great contribution to science before the age of 30 will never do so. Tragically, innovators often do lose their originality over time. After Einstein transformed physics with two papers on relativity, he opposed quantum mechanics, which became the next major revolution in the field. To punish me for my contempt for authority, fate made me an authority myself, Einstein lamented. But this decline isn't inevitable. When companies run suggestion boxes, there is evidence that older employees tend to submit more ideas and higher quality ideas than their younger colleagues, with the most valuable suggestions coming from employees older than 55. And in technology startups that have raised venture capital funding, the average founder is 38. In the arts and sciences, Chicago economist David Galenson shows that although we're quick to remember the young geniuses who peak early, there are plenty of old masters who soar much later. In medicine, for every James Watson who helped to discover the double helix structure of DNA at age 25, there is a Roger Sperry who identified different specializations between the right and left hemispheres of the brain at age 49. In film, for every Orson Welles, whose masterpiece Citizen Kane was his very first feature film at age 25, there is an Alfred Hitchcock who made his three most popular films 3 decades into his career at ages 59, Vertigo, 60, North by Northwest, and 61, Psycho. In poetry, for every E.E. Cummings who penned his first influential poem at 22 and more than half of his best work before turning 40, there is a Robert Frost, who wrote 92% of his most reprinted poems after 40. What explains these dramatically different life cycles of creativity? Why do some peak early and others bloom late? The time at which we reach our heights of originality and how long they last depends on our styles of thinking. When Galenson studied creators, he discovered 2 radically different styles of innovation, conceptual and experimental. Conceptual innovators formulate a big idea and set out to execute it. Experimental innovators solve problems through trial and error, learning and evolving as they go along. They are at work on a particular problem, but they don't have a specific solution in mind at the outset. Instead of planning in advance, they figure it out as they go. To paraphrase writer E.M. Forster, how can I know what I think until I see what I say? According to Galenson, conceptual innovators are sprinters, and experimental innovators are marathoners. When he studied economists who won the Nobel Prize, on average the conceptual innovators did their most influential work at 43, whereas the experimental innovators did theirs at 61. When he analyzed the most often reproduced poems by famous poets, conceptual innovators authored their best works at 28, compared with age 39 for experimental innovators. And in an independent study of every physicist who has ever won the Nobel Prize, of the young geniuses under 30, exactly half were conceptual innovators who did theoretical work. Among the old masters, 45 and above, 92% did experimental work. These fundamental differences between conceptual and experimental innovators explain why some originals peak early and others bloom late. Conceptual innovation can be done quickly because it doesn't require years of methodical investigation. When Watson and Crick discovered the double helix structure of DNA, they didn't need to wait for data to amass. They had built a three-dimensional theoretical model and examined X-ray images provided by Rosalind Franklin. In addition, conceptual breakthroughs tend to occur early because it is easiest to come up with a strikingly original insight when we approach a problem with a fresh perspective. Conceptual innovators normally make their most important contributions to a discipline not long after their first exposure to it, Galenson finds. For this reason, conceptual innovators become less original once they're entrenched in conventional ways of approaching problems. As Galenson explains, the inability of aging conceptual innovators to match the brilliant achievements of their youth is not a product of their depletion of a stock of some magical elixir of artistry. Instead, it is caused by the impact of accumulating experience. The real enemies of conceptual innovators are the establishment of fixed habits of thought. Conceptual innovators may become the captives of an important early achievement. As a conceptual innovator, this was Einstein's problem. When he developed his theory of special relativity, he wasn't conducting scientific studies, but thought experiments. He was imagining himself chasing a beam of light. His major contributions to science were ideas and theories that explained the results of other people's experiments. Once Einstein had internalized his principles of relativity, he struggled to accommodate the departures from those principles that quantum physics demanded. In poetry, Galenson points out that E.E. Cummings faced a similar hurdle. After imagining his own rules of language, grammar, and punctuation in his early 20s, by age 50, as one critic remarked, Cummings is still the experimentalist of one experiment. The fascinating thing about Cummings is that he is always talking about growth and always remains the same. Later, when Cummings was 65, another reviewer commented that Cummings is a daringly original poet, but his books are all exactly alike. As psychologist Abraham Maslow noted, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Conversely, while experimental innovation can require years or decades to accumulate the requisite knowledge and skill, it becomes a more sustainable source of originality. It took Roger Sperry years to conduct experiments with split-brain cats and human patients to determine how the brain hemispheres worked. Robert Frost wrote none of his most reproduced poems in his 20s and just 8% in his 30s, finally blossoming in his 40s and again in his 60s. Step by step, poet Robert Lowell observed, Frost tested his observation of places and people until his best poems had the richness of great novels. Like an explorer, Frost gathered material by venturing out into the world, listening carefully to real conversations. I would never use a word or combination of words that I hadn't heard used in running speech, Frost acknowledged. Each poem was an experiment in mixing different elements. No surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader, he was fond of saying. When I begin a poem, I don't know. I don't want a poem that I can tell was written toward a good ending. You've got to be the happy discoverer of your ends. Conceptual innovators tend to generate original ideas early, but risk copying themselves. The experimental approach takes longer, but proves more renewable. Instead of reproducing our past ideas, experiments enable us to continue discovering new ones. Mark Twain published Adventures of Huckleberry Finn at age 49 using a trial-and-error method, scholars note, and discovered his pliable plot as he went along, writing without a definite resolution or plan in mind. Twain himself commented, "As the short tale grows into the long tale, the original intention or motif is apt to get abolished and find itself superseded by a quite different one." To sustain our originality as we age and accumulate expertise, our best bet is to adopt an experimental approach. We can make fewer plans in advance for what we want to create, and start testing out different kinds of tentative ideas and solutions. Eventually, if we're patient enough, we may stumble onto something that's novel and useful. The experimental approach served Leonardo da Vinci well. He was 46 when he finished painting The Last Supper, and in his early 50s when he started working on the Mona Lisa. Only by drawing did he truly come to understand, was his vision clarified, one scholar wrote. Another observed that Leonardo works like a sculptor modeling in clay who never accepts any form as final, but goes on creating, even at the risk of obscuring his original intentions. Martin Luther King Jr., too, was an experimental innovator. Despite being just 34 when he gave his dream speech, it was his 20th year of speaking publicly about civil rights. At 15, he made the state finals for delivering an original speech on civil rights. He spent the intervening decades testing out a range of possible lyrics to articulate his vision. In the thousands of speeches that he delivered, he was constantly rehearsing different melodies and refrains. Having gained the experience of an old master, he achieved originality, as management scholar Carl Weick describes it, by putting old things in new combinations and new things in old combinations. Good things come to those who wait, and for experimentalists, it's never too late to become original. After Frank Lloyd Wright received the contract for Falling Water, his most celebrated architectural work, he procrastinated for nearly a year while making sporadic drawings before finally completing the design at age 68. Raymond Davis shared the Nobel Prize in Physics for research that he started at 51 and finished at the tender age of 80. The more experiments you run, the less constrained you become by your ideas from the past. You learn from what you discover in your audience, on the canvas, or in the data. Instead of getting mired in the tunnel vision of your imagination, by looking out into the world, you improve the acuity of your peripheral vision. Sprinting is a fine strategy for a young genius, but becoming an old master requires the patience of experimentation to run a marathon. Both are paths to creativity. Yet for those of us who aren't struck by a bolt of insight, slow and steady experimentation can light the way to a longer stretch of originality. Of course, not every unaccomplished 65-year-old is some undiscovered experimental innovator, author Daniel Pink reflects. But it might bolster the resolve of the relentlessly curious, the constantly tinkering, the dedicated tortoises undaunted by the blur of the hairs. Chapter 5. Goldilocks and the Trojan Horse. Creating and Maintaining Coalitions. Now, the star-belly sneetches had bellies with stars. The plain-belly sneetches had none upon thars. Those stars weren't so big. They were really so small, you might think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. But because they had stars, all the star-belly sneetches would brag, "We're the best kind of sneetch on the beaches." With their snoots in the air, they would sniff and they'd snort, "We'll have nothing to do with the plain-belly sort." Dr. Seuss. Memories of her greatness have faded, but no one did more for women's suffrage in America than Lucy Stone. In 1855, she took a stand for women's rights that moved thousands to follow in her footsteps, calling themselves Lucy Stoners in homage. Over the next century, the Lucy Stone League included aviator Amelia Earhart, poet Edna St. Vincent Millay, and artist Georgia O'Keeffe. Among today's women who qualify as Lucy Stoners are Beyoncé, Sheryl Sandberg, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Spanx founder Sarah Blakely. Lucy Stone was the first woman in America to keep her own name after getting married. It was one of her many firsts. She was the first woman from Massachusetts to earn a bachelor's degree. She was the first American to become a full-time lecturer for women's rights, mobilizing countless supporters and converting numerous adversaries to join the movement. She became one of only a handful of women who spoke in public at all, let alone on women's rights. She led national conventions, and she launched the country's foremost women's newspaper, the Woman's Journal, which ran for half a century. In the words of Carrie Chapman Catt, the suffragist who campaigned successfully for the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, "The suffrage success of today is not conceivable without the Woman's Journal's part in it." In 1851, Stone organized a women's rights convention, but didn't take the podium until she was coaxed into speaking on the last day. "We want to be something more than the appendages of society," Stone pronounced, calling for women to petition state legislatures for the rights to vote and hold property. Her remarks became known as the speech that set the women's rights movement on fire. Her words made their way across the Atlantic Ocean, where they inspired British philosophers John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill to publish a famous essay on the enfranchisement of women, which helped to mobilize women's suffrage activists in England. In America, perhaps the most significant effect was on a Rochester teacher named Susan B. Anthony. Stone's speech inspired her to join the suffrage movement. 2 years later, the other great suffragist of the era, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, wrote a glowing note to Anthony about Stone. "We have no woman who compares with her." For the next decade and a half, Stone, Anthony, and Stanton collaborated as the renowned leaders of the women's suffrage crusade. But long before they could realize their shared goal of equal voting rights for women, their coalition crumbled. In 1869, Anthony and Stanton severed their collaboration with Stone, splitting off to form their own women's suffrage organization. The former allies fought bitterly as rivals, publishing their own newspapers, petitioning and fundraising separately, and lobbying legislatures independently. The division, historian Jean Baker laments, led to a duplication of energies in a movement that was numerically small and organizationally limited. It also reinforced stereotypes that women were unfit for political life, encouraging newspapers to focus on the hens at war story rather than on that of the great cause itself. Anthony masterminded a plot to poach leaders from Stone's organization, and the animosity that Anthony and Stanton harbored toward Stone was so intense that they wrote her organization out of their history of the suffrage movement. This act appalled even Stanton's own daughter, who rectified the omission by writing a chapter on Stone's efforts herself. Since the three leaders shared a deep commitment to the same cause, why did they end up in such a heated, destructive conflict? This chapter examines how originals form alliances to advance their goals, and how to overcome the barriers that prevent coalitions from succeeding. By definition, most efforts to change the status quo involve a movement by a minority group to challenge a majority. Coalitions are powerful, but they are also inherently unstable. They depend heavily on the relationships among individual members. Lucy Stone's conflict with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton shattered the most important alliance in the suffrage movement, nearly causing its demise. Through an analysis of their challenges, along with a talented entrepreneur's struggle to convince people to give her idea a chance, a hit Disney movie that almost didn't get made, and the collapse of the Occupy Wall Street movement, you'll see how building effective coalitions involves striking a delicate balance between venerable virtues and pragmatic policies. In doing so, you'll find out why singing "O Canada" can help us form alliances, why common tactics can be more influential than common values, why Western states won suffrage sooner than states in the East and the South, and why it's often wiser to partner with enemies than frenemies. The key insight is a Goldilocks theory of coalition formation. The originals who start a movement will often be its most radical members, whose ideas and ideals will prove too hot for those who follow their lead. To form alliances with opposing groups, it's best to temper the cause, cooling it as much as possible. Yet to draw allies into joining the cause itself, what's needed is a moderately tempered message that is neither too hot nor too cold, but just right. The narcissism of small differences. We assume that common goals bind groups together, but the reality is that they often drive groups apart. According to Dartmouth psychologist Judith White, a lens for understanding these fractures is the concept of horizontal hostility. Even though they share a fundamental objective, radical groups often disparage more mainstream groups as imposters and sellouts. As Sigmund Freud wrote a century ago, it is precisely the minor differences in people who are otherwise alike that form the basis of feelings of strangeness and hostility between them. White noticed horizontal hostility everywhere. When a deaf woman won the Miss America crown, instead of cheering her on as a trailblazer, deaf activists protested. Since she spoke orally rather than using sign language, she wasn't deaf enough. When a light-skinned black woman was appointed as a law professor at one university, its Black Students Association objected on the grounds that she wasn't black enough. A radical environmental activist dismissed the more mainstream Greenpeace as a mindless monster motivated by eco-buck profits and a dynamic threat to the integrity of the green movement. To explain why this kind of animosity happened, White led fascinating research on horizontal hostility in different movements and minority groups. In one study, vegans and vegetarians evaluated members of their own groups and one another's groups relative to members of the general public. Vegans showed nearly three times as much prejudice toward vegetarians as vegetarians did toward vegans. In the eyes of the more extreme vegans, the mainstream vegetarians were wannabes. If they really cared about the cause, they wouldn't eat animal products like eggs. In another study in Greece, members of the most conservative party judged the most similar party more unfavorably than they did a progressive party. And members of the most liberal party were much harsher toward the progressive party than towards even the most conservative party. Orthodox Jews evaluated conservative Jewish women more negatively than Jewish women who didn't practice or observe religious holidays at all. The message was clear. If you were a true believer, you'd be all in. The more strongly you identify with an extreme group, the harder you seek to differentiate yourself from more moderate groups that threaten your values. It was this kind of horizontal hostility that caused Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton to split off from Lucy Stone. Anthony and Stanton were relatively radical. Stone was more mainstream. The earth between them cracked in 1866 when Anthony and Stanton partnered with a known racist, George Francis Train, who supported women's suffrage because he believed women could help to curtail the political influence of African Americans. Stone was outraged to see them campaigning with Train and allowing him to bankroll their efforts. The fault line only grew wider when Anthony and Stanton opposed the 15th Amendment proposal to grant African American men the right to vote. They drew a hard line. If women weren't given the right to vote, other minority groups shouldn't be allowed it either. Their position was radical not only because it was inflexible, but also because they were trying to reach liberal constituents who favored the amendment. Stone was more sympathetic to the abolitionist cause. At an equal rights convention, she attempted to build a bridge between black activists and Anthony and Stanton, announcing her support for a continued alliance. Both are perhaps right. Women has an ocean of wrongs too deep for any plummet, and the Negro, too, has an ocean of wrongs that cannot be fathomed. I thank God for the 15th Amendment and hope that it will be adopted in every state. I will be thankful in my soul if anybody can get out of that terrible pit. Anthony and Stanton viewed Stone's support of voting rights for black men as a betrayal of the women's cause. They reneged on their commitment to a joint organization and announced the formation of their own national women's suffrage organization the following week, in May 1869. Stone and a group of colleagues published a letter calling for a more comprehensive organization, but it was to no avail. By the fall, they had little choice but to form their own group. For more than two decades, they maintained their distance, working independently in some cases and at cross purposes in others. With the women's suffrage movement splintered, Lucy Stone needed new allies, as did Anthony and Stanton. They all found support in an unexpected place, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, WCTU, which had been formed to fight alcohol abuse, as drunken men often abused their wives and left their families in poverty. In contrast to the suffrage groups, the WCTU was heavily conservative. Its members tended to be middle and upper-class women with strong religious beliefs and traditional values. Yet somehow, coalitions between the WCTU and suffragists sprang up in almost every state in the nation. The reasons for suffragists to partner with the WCTU were clear. The suffrage movement had stalled in influencing legislation. A surge of anti-suffrage organizations was forming to work against them, and suffrage membership was dwindling. By the early 1880s, Stanton and Anthony's organization was down to just 100 members. The WCTU, meanwhile, was experiencing a membership explosion, growing from a few thousand in 1874 to 13,000 in 1876 and well over 100,000 by 1890. With the support of the country's largest women's organization, suffragists could make meaningful progress. The puzzle is why the WCTU agreed to partner with suffragists. In a clever experiment, Stanford researchers Scott Wiltermuth and Chip Heath randomly assigned people in groups of three to listen to the national anthem, O Canada, under different conditions of synchrony. In the control condition, participants read the words silently while the song played. In the synchronous condition, they sang the song out loud together. In the asynchronous condition, they all sang, but not in unison. Each person heard the song at a different tempo. The participants thought they were being tested on their singing, but there was a twist. After singing, they moved into what was supposedly a different study, where they had a chance to keep money for themselves or cooperate by sharing it with a group. The few minutes they spent singing shouldn't have affected their behavior, but it did. The group that sang together shared significantly more. They reported feeling more similar to each other and more like a team than participants in the other conditions. In an experiment led by Yale psychologist Erica Boothby, people liked chocolate better when they tasted it at the same time as another person. "I hate chocolate, so this experiment would not have worked with me." But their follow-up study showed that eating disgustingly bitter chocolate was even more unpleasant when tasted simultaneously with someone else. Apparently, both positive and negative experiences are amplified when we share them, leading to even greater feelings of similarity. In seeking alliances with groups that share our values, we overlook the importance of sharing our strategic tactics. Recently, sociologists Woo-Seok Jung and Braden King of Northwestern University and Sarah Soule of Stanford University tracked the emergence of unusual alliances between social movements, like coalitions between environmental and gay rights activists, the women's movement and the peace movement, and a Marine base and a Native American tribe. They found that shared tactics were an important predictor of alliances. Even if they care about different causes, groups find affinity when they use the same methods of engagement. If you've spent the past decade taking part in protests and marches, it's easy to feel a sense of shared identity and community with another organization that operates the same way. Lucy Stone recognized that common goals weren't sufficient for a coalition to prosper, noting, "People will differ as to what they consider the best methods and means." Stanton, for her part, pointed to the difference in methods as the essential issue dividing the two associations. Stone was committed to campaigning at the state level. Anthony and Stanton wanted a federal constitutional amendment. Stone involved men in her organization. Anthony and Stanton favored an exclusively female membership. Stone sought to inspire change through speaking and meetings. Anthony and Stanton were more confrontational, with Anthony voting illegally and encouraging other women to follow suit. The suffragists who formed alliances with the temperance activists were more moderate in their methods, which helped the two groups find common ground. At the same time that women were organizing local WCTU clubs, Lucy Stone introduced suffrage clubs. Both groups had extensive histories with lobbying and publishing. They began to work together to lobby and speak in front of state legislatures, publish articles and distribute literature, and hold public suffrage meetings, rallies, and debates. Shared tactics only facilitate alliances up to a point. When the overlap in tactics between groups was more than 61%, coalitions became less likely. When their methods are pretty much the same, groups simply have less to learn and gain from one another. Their efforts are more likely to be redundant. Although the WCTU and suffrage groups shared a number of tactics, they also had some unique methods to teach one another. The suffragists began to march in parades and set up booths at fairs. The WCTU increasingly used petitions. Also, status differences mattered. Movements were more likely to align when one had moderately higher status than the other, as opposed to when there was no status difference or an extreme status difference. It's obvious that a lower status movement would pursue the visibility associated with a higher status partner. But there are benefits to the higher status group, too. Sociologists Jung, King, and Soule explain, "As challengers to the established social order, movements need to refresh and update their agenda continuously in order to be seen as cutting-edge, authentic, and relevant. If they fail to innovate their movement agenda and engage with new ideas, a movement can become obsolete and lose touch with its original constituency. For this reason, high-status movements may seek to absorb newly emerging or previously ignored vintage issues." Together, suffragists and temperance activists persuaded several states to allow women to vote. And in doing so, the suffragists discovered a profound principle about gaining allies. That principle is best illuminated by a young, visionary entrepreneur who found a surprising way to get naysayers to give her idea a chance. Tempered Radicals. In 2011, a college senior named Meredith Perry noticed that something very basic was wrong with technology. She didn't need a cord to make phone calls or connect to the internet. Everything that used to be wired was now wireless, except for one thing. Sitting in her dorm room, she was still tethered to the wall by the most ancient component of her devices, the power that charged them. To use her phone and her computer, she had to plug them in. She wanted wireless power. She started thinking of things that could beam energy through the air. A signal in a TV remote was too weak. Radio waves were too inefficient. And X-rays were too dangerous. Then she came across a device that could convert physical vibration into energy. If you put it under a train, for example, you could collect the energy the train generated. Although it wasn't practical to have people gathering near trains to capture their energy, she realized that sound travels through the air by vibration. What if she could use ultrasound, which is invisible and silent, to generate air vibrations and convert them into wireless power? Her physics professors said it was impossible. Ultrasonic engineers agreed it couldn't be done. Some of the world's most respected scientists told her she was wasting her time on the effort. But then she won an invention competition, and a journalist challenged her to demo the technology at a digital conference just 4 weeks later. With a proof of concept, but no working prototype, she had a chicken-and-egg problem. She needed funding to build a prototype, but her idea was so radical that investors wanted to see a prototype first. As the solo founder of a technology startup with no engineering background, she needed allies to move forward. 3 years later, I met Perry at a Google event. After landing $750,000 in seed money from Mark Cuban, Marissa Meyer, and Peter Thiel's Founders Fund, her team had just finished its first functional prototype. It could power devices faster than a wire, at longer distances, and would be ready for consumers in 2 years. By the end of 2014, her company, Ubeam, had accumulated 18 patents and $10 million in venture funding. Perry took her place on stage in a lineup that included Snoop Dogg, a Nobel Prize winner, and former President Bill Clinton. She was the only one to get a standing ovation. Debate continued about how well the product would work, but she had overcome the fundamental barrier to proving the viability of the technology. Every single person that is now working for the company didn't think it was possible or was extremely skeptical, Perry said. Perry faced an extreme version of every original struggle in challenging the status quo, overcoming the skepticism of potential key stakeholders. Her initial efforts fell flat. She reached out to scores of technical experts who were so quick to point out the flaws in the math and physics that they wouldn't even consider working with her. It probably didn't help that she was offering to hire them as contractors on deferred payment. They might never see a check. Finally, Perry made a move that flew in the face of every piece of wisdom she had heard about influence. She simply stopped telling experts what it was she was trying to create. Instead of explaining her plan to generate wireless power, she merely provided the specifications of the technology she wanted. Her old message had been, "I'm trying to build a transducer to send power over the air." Her new pitch disguised the purpose. "I'm looking for someone to design a transducer with these parameters. Can you make this part?" The approach worked. She persuaded two acoustics experts to design a transmitter, another to design a receiver, and an electrical engineer to construct the electronics. "In my head, it all came together. Worst comes to worst, somebody would sue me," Perry admits. "There was no other way, given my knowledge and skill set." Soon, she had collaborators on board with doctorates from Oxford and Stanford, with math and simulations confirming the idea was viable in theory. It was enough to attract a first round of funding and a talented chief technology officer who had initially been highly skeptical. "Once I showed him all the patents," he said, "Oh shit, this actually can work." In a popular TED talk and book, Simon Sinek argues that if we want to inspire people, we should start with why. If we communicate the vision behind our ideas, the purpose guiding our products, people will flock to us. This is excellent advice, unless you're doing something original that challenges the status quo. When people championing moral change explain their why, it runs the risk of clashing with deep-seated convictions. When creative nonconformists explain their why, it may violate common notions of what's possible. Researchers Deborah Meyerson and Maureen Scully have found that to succeed, originals must often become tempered radicals. They believe in values that depart from traditions and ideas that go against the grain, yet they learn to tone down their radicalism by presenting their beliefs and ideas in ways that are less shocking and more appealing to mainstream audiences. Meredith Perry is a tempered radical. She made an implausible idea plausible by obscuring its most extreme feature. When she couldn't persuade technical experts to take a leap with her, she convinced them to take a few steps by masking her purpose. Shifting the focus from why to how can help people become less radical. In a series of experiments, when people with extreme political views were asked to explain the reasons behind their policy preferences,